Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Our speaker tonight is Eric R. from the Feet First Speakers Group.
Okay. Yeah, turn them all off. That'd be good. My name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic. And it's absolutely an honor and a privilege to be standing up here tonight. If you would have asked me a year ago, I would have loved the opportunity to do it. When I was asked this afternoon, I was like, oh, God, no. But I'm really grateful to be given this opportunity and tremendously thankful to the members of this group and to this program and fellowship for giving me a life worth living today. My job is, as I've heard of many other speakers say, is really pretty simple. I'll tell you what I was like, what happened, and what my life is like today as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Where to begin? Grew up not too far from here, right down in Perkasie. Pretty average childhood, really. Pretty privileged. Looking back, you would ask me 5 years ago, I would have said my childhood kind of sucked. You'd ask me 2 years ago, I would have said it, it was eh. Today, I can look back and just say, I had a pretty average, decent childhood, and I had parents that absolutely loved me and did the best that they could, and wanted nothing other than to give me every opportunity that life has. And my father was a heavy drinker. I'm pretty certain he was alcoholic. He'd been to several rehabs. My last arrest, I actually recall going to jail with my dad because, I was hungover from the night before and the constable came to get me for my last DUI and proceeded to punch out the constable. So the two of us went together. I have three older siblings. I have two sisters and a brother who passed away when I was 19 from this disease. I remember as a pretty young child, I was the youngest kid, and I remember feeling different. Pretty often I actually felt superior rather than inferior. I was given pretty decent intellect, and in elementary school I was doing like fifth grade math books in first grade, and I was just whatever, and I always felt like better than everybody, which was really kind of silly. But I never really felt comfortable. I remember being 5 years old, my mom coming in and finding me reading Henry Robbins or something novel, Harold Robbins novel, The Betsy. And I just told her, "Don't worry, I'm skipping over the dirty words." That was just kind of the kid I was. In elementary school, I did pretty well. I seemed to get along fairly well with my peers. And as I got closer to the end of elementary school, the relationship between my mom and dad was starting to disintegrate. My father's drinking. All those years growing up, I watched, bedroom was right across the hall from my parents, so I get to hear the fights several nights a week, and I remember begging him numerous times to please just stop. Can't you see what you're doing to the family? And it's like the big book says, fraught the emotional appeal doesn't really get through to us. And he made many promises, but never any real decisions. I don't know that my father ever really believed that he was alcoholic. He always thought he couldn't accept that that the alcohol had him. But clearly, as my story will demonstrate, it certainly had me. Excuse me if I jump around a little bit. I am a bit nervous standing up here. It's funny, a couple weeks ago I had to fill in for the chairperson, and I actually said it would be easier to speak than it was chairing. I guess I was wrong. So anyway, towards the end of elementary school, I watched my older siblings starting to use some drugs and also drinking, partying. My oldest sister's 8 years older. Second one was 6 years older. My brother was 4 years older. So I got to see, the effects, of them living their lives. And and the damage. And I remember they brought one of those assemblies into school with the police officers with this poster board with all the drug paraphernalia on it and all this stuff. And I remember saying, I'll never do that. You know, and thinking about my dad's drinking, I will never do that. Wasn't very long after that when I started. When I was 11 years old, my father was very successful in business, and that was, I think, the one thing that kept him from, you know, seeing, you know, he always said he sometimes would admit he was alcoholic, but always said he was functional, you know, because he had his own business and had some material success. There was this business trip that he went on, and my mom and I were to go down to Washington, D.C. to meet him and then go on from there to, what the heck is it, in Virginia, Busch Gardens. And we pulled into this hotel in Washington, D.C., and my father was down in the lobby bar with a bunch of other car dealers making disparaging remarks about their ethnicities. And my mom was just mortified and asked me to please get him out of there, you know, so we kind of move on and start our vacation. Just, it was an awful scene. That was the night my mom decided that she had enough and, you know, the marriage was over. And not long after that, they split up and I went and moved with my mom. And, you know, before that, I had already started dabbling. You know, the first time I remember getting drunk, I know I had tasted alcohol before this, but the first time I really remember getting drunk, I was 12 years old. My parents were having a square dance of all things at our house for Halloween. And a lot of people around my dad, being, you know, a heavy drinker or alcoholic, always had a very well-staffed bar. And people would leave drinks around. And my neighbor and I, who was the same age, just kept drinking all night and watching Monty Python and the Holy Grail. It was an awesome night. You know, I remember laughing my ass off, having a fabulous time, and I don't know if I got sick that night. I'm not sure if I blacked out. I just know something clicked. You know, and I was like, I felt better. You know, and clearly I was 12 years old, 13 years old, and you know, I wasn't going to start drinking every day, and I don't think I ever drank every day. You know, it started to progress. By the age of 14, I'm stealing my parents' cars, driving around Bedminster Township with, you know, a 6-pack or 12-pack, whatever we could get. I think there's one amends that, you know, I just keep thinking there's an amends there, but sponsors have told me that I don't have to go back to the guy that was older that bought me beer and got arrested. I don't know, you know. I guess I'm willing, if a guy crosses my path, I'll try to clean that up, but whatever. So when my parents split up and we moved to Dublin, you know, it was really my drinking, and I used quite a few other substances as well. It was easier to get as a teenager. That really took off. You know, I had become a daily pot smoker, and you know, for many years that was my habit. You know, I'd smoke pot every day, and on the weekends I would drink, you know, when I could. By the age of 16, I'd gone out to a high school football game with three buddies and his my one friend's 68 Barracuda or whatever it was, and we had a fifth of 151, and I think I drank probably about a third of it, maybe closer to a half. And friend crashed his car that night, took some farmer with a backhoe to pull us out of a ditch, and another friend to tow his car home, and they got to the house, and he couldn't get me out of the car. You know, he had to go up to the door. My mom was already worried about where was I. Knock on the door, and he and my mom had to drag me into the apartment. I remember waking up the following morning in a puddle of my own urine and vomit, and this big note from my mom: Eric, don't you dare go out. Mom, no love, Mom, no nothing, you know. I was like, ooh, something's wrong. As a result of that episode, I was not allowed to get my license until I was almost 18. And it's probably a good thing. When I started junior high school, they put me in these gifted classes. And, you know, this is when, also at the same time that I'm starting to smoke pot a lot and drink. So, you know, although I had tested pretty highly, once I got in these classes, I really didn't feel like I fit in with these guys playing violin and, you know, doing art. I'd rather hang out with the guys getting high and skipping class. And, you know, I managed to hold it together in junior high, but by the time I was in high school, you know, all I could think was, you know, I just don't want to be with these people. You know, I don't feel like I belong here. And I continued to go to the classes, but didn't really pay attention, didn't apply myself at all. You know, it got to the point at the end of high school where my senior year in high school, my final report card was like four D's and one A. I had an A in money management, which is probably the biggest joke when you look at my financial history over the years. So I was always good at theory. The application of knowledge was never one of my strong suits. I could study something and tell you all about it, and when you hear my story in recovery, you'll understand exactly how that applies. Anyway, I graduated high school, and because it was expected of me, I signed up to go to Delaware Valley College in Doylestown. I wasn't ready to go away. I had no idea what I wanted to be when I grew up, and still don't. But I went to Del Valle, and you know, I just commuted, and I'd go to the first class of the day, and I'd meet other people like me, and I'd go out and start partying, and you know, I somehow managed to pass most of my classes that year, but knew I didn't want to go back. All along, I had been working for my father's business, so I had some money, and I'd become more and more alienated from my family, from my siblings particularly. My brother, a lot of the time growing up, was pretty abusive to me. You know, looking back in hindsight, I think he really just saw that I was headed down the same path he was, and he knew that his path was a dead end, and it did prove to be so. And I think he was just trying to discourage me from following in his footsteps, but you know, there was part of me that really looked up to him, and that's all I wanted to do, you know. I remember in ninth grade hearing his name over the loudspeaker every day and thinking how cool that was, you know, being called to the office every day. And I remember the episode when, you know, he came walking into the principal's office with a beer in his hand and a cigarette in his mouth and called the principal a wimp and said, how many days can you give me for this one? You know, and went out and did donuts in front of the high school in his 68 Mustang. And, you know, he was my hero. That was the kind of stuff I wanted to be able to do but never had the courage. And even at, you know, the drinking didn't give me enough courage to pull that kind of thing back. So when I was 18, in that first year of Del Valle, my brother went away to rehab for the first time. And actually the only time. He went to Horsham Clinic, and he had begun using an awful lot of cocaine. He had gotten married, and he had been fired from my dad's business for stealing from him. Was working at a motorcycle dealership, and you know, it just got really bad. Looked like he was going to do okay for a while, but sometime around March or April of 1985, a mutual friend, one of his friends that I had become kind of friendly with, was killed in a motorcycle accident. And the last time I spoke to my brother was at this guy's funeral. And the last words I remember my brother saying was, if, you know, I don't want to come to another one of these things for a long, long time. Like less than 6 weeks later, we were burying my brother, who also was killed in a motorcycle accident. It was right around Mother's Day 1985, and, you know, just an average day. You know, I was out doing what I do, working for my dad in the afternoon and driving home from work. Actually, I was driving down to Percocet to meet somebody to get some weed. And I had this little voice in my head. You know, I was driving down 309 and past the motorcycle dealership where my brother worked, and something was telling me to stop and see him, talk to him. And, you know, the desire to get that, to go and get that weed, outweighed that voice in my head. And if there was one event in my life that I could go back and change, it would be, you know, that one decision. You know, I don't know that it would have changed anything, but it would have alleviated me from suffering all those years of beating myself up that, you know, I was responsible for his death. Clearly I wasn't, you know, but I believed I was, because I just didn't listen to that voice. And, you know, it was 2 o'clock the following morning when my mom got the call that he had been killed in this motorcycle accident, and it's devastating. You know, he left behind a 3-month-old baby daughter and a beautiful young wife. And, you know, my drinking just really progressed my escapism from life really progressed. Wasn't long after that, just a matter of a couple months. I had enrolled to go away to Millersville University the following fall. And it was sometime in August. Was out commiserating with one of his friends and driving around drinking, and I had my first DUI. Ran through a stop sign straight across the street into a bridge abutment, and wound up in the hospital in intensive care for about 4 or 5 days. Missed orientation at Millersville. And I began to question if drinking was a problem. And I'm 19 years old, I guess, at the time. And I went away to Millersville, but I, you know, obviously arrived up there late. I had this goofy roommate from, like, Williamsport or something, you know, really straight-cut kid. And you know, he was actually just a nice guy. I just didn't know how to relate to him. But I began to think that, you know, maybe the drinking was a problem, but I wasn't really ready to admit that my drinking was a problem. I thought it was, you know, still wanted to blame it on my dad's drinking. You know, if he was okay, I'll be all right. If we could just fix him, I'll be okay. So I started going to some ACOA meetings, my first exposure to any 12-step program, and it helped. It did help. I managed to stay away from drinking for the first semester. I went to see a counselor up there at school, and you know, but eventually, just like, you know, our book says, you know, an alcoholic without a drink will become restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, without a program for living, I have no tools to live. So although therapy helped a little bit, going to these meetings helped a little bit, the fact that I was looking outside for the, you know, trying to find the problem out there to fix, really kept me from really getting any better. You know, come the spring semester, I had to drink. You know, I really had no other option. You know, I'd become that uncomfortable in my skin that I didn't know what else to do. So I started drinking again. You know, in that second semester, I failed every class. I couldn't even pass swimming. I don't think I went one time. You know, I'd sit in my dorm room and get high and drink and play canasta all day long. To this day, I don't even remember how to play canasta. I don't know how I played it so much. I remember, you know, the Challenger explosion, Space Shuttle Challenger, and sitting in my dorm room, stoned, you know, playing canasta and watching this on TV and just like, oh, you know, it's sad. A lot of events like that in my life. That was the last year of college for me. By this point, my mom had remarried, met a really great guy, moved down to Florida, and she saw that I was really going nowhere, and she thought, you know, maybe it'll help if we can get him come down and, you know, move down here and give him a fresh start. And she invited me to move down to her house. And I packed up the car. I had a little pickup that my dad had given me. And I packed up and started driving down to Florida. And shortly after I crossed the border into Florida, I pulled into a parking lot along, I think it was Flagler Beach in Daytona County or whatever, Flagler County. And I'm sitting in the parking lot rolling a joint, and a cop pulls up behind me. He never found the pot, which, you know, thank God. But he did. He ran my license and informed me that my license was supposed to have been suspended in Pennsylvania, and I never surrendered it. So he wouldn't let me drive. I had to call my mom. I was still 3 hours north of her there in Florida. And, you know, those years in Florida were really quite pathetic. You know, it was a couple months until I could get a license. I finally got a job working in the produce section at the supermarket, which was fine. You know, it was good. I met the only friend that I really had the whole time I lived down in Florida there. And but I just couldn't keep up with the routine of that job, you know. Because basically 8 hours for me at that point without being able to get high or do something just wasn't working, you know. I discovered the beauties of delivering pizza, you know, being an independent contractor kind of deal like that. You know, it was great. I absolutely, you know, there's times if I'm delusional, I can think back that was the times of my life, you know, driving around with the bong behind the seat and, you know, making a lot of cash. You know, I spent all my money on toys and beer and weed. And You know, but it was so pathetic. I was so isolated. You know, I lived in Florida from the age of 20, 21 to 24, and I didn't date. I had no dates. You know, I had no ability to relate to women or, you know, I had one friend. I went to one party the whole time I was there. I asked one girl to dance. She turned me down. She said, "You're disgusting." And I was pretty drunk. And I left there, and this was in 1987. I hit a car, flipped the car into a ditch. It's a felony hit and run charge. By the grace of God, I didn't kill anybody. Also, by the grace of God, the people that I hit did not show up in court when it went to court. So the felony charges were dropped down to a misdemeanor. And, you know, in hindsight, sometimes I think if it had been adjudicated a felony and I'd served some real time, maybe I would have gotten sober sooner. But the reality is that wouldn't have mattered. You know, it took everything that it took for me to get where I am today. And, you know, I didn't get sober then. You know, it was 2 years later, after paying thousands and thousands of dollars of fines and restitution and everything else, that I moved back up to Pennsylvania and continued doing the same things. Had that last DUI. I was living back at Dad's. Now I'm 26 years old, 27 years old, something like that. And, you know, something inside me, the wiring in my brain, got a little fried from using a lot of drugs and drinking. And somewhere in spring of 1989, I was diagnosed manic and hospitalized up at St. Luke's in Quakertown for almost a month. I had run $40,000 or so in credit card debt up in a period of about 6 weeks. I had maybe slept 3 or 4 hours, you know, in a month. And when I got out of there, that was my first real sobriety date, July 26th of 1989. I knew by that point that I was pretty screwed up. I was pretty heavily medicated and a lot of therapy for a year. And I managed to stay dry for almost 6 years, from 1989 to 1995, without a program, without any God in my life, without any steps in my life, without a fellowship. You know, I went to meetings. I went to beginners meeting one night a week for 3 months. I got a 3 month coin, and in my mind, I was cured. You know, and the book talks about how we can use things to treat our alcoholism, and I've seen it in a lot of people. You know, I while I was in the hospital, manic, nuts, can't sleep. I'm sitting up at night on the psych unit at Quakertown, and I got to talking to this nurse, this male nurse that was there sitting up, and I'm thinking, it makes a lot of money to do that. I could do that. You know, so I got this great idea. I'm going to go to school and become a nurse, because really I had no direction in my life, no idea how to contribute anything worthwhile in life. And when I got out of there, I started pursuing a career in nursing. You know, I enrolled back at Del Valle College to get all the prereqs out of the way. I actually lived on campus that time. I was 26, 27 years old. I had a 18-year-old roommate from Japan. It was really interesting. I was working night shift down at Standard Press Steel in Jenkintown, so I'd go to class during the day. I would sleep in the afternoon while he was at class, and then I would get up at like 10 o'clock at, or 9:30 at night, get on the train, go down to Jenkintown, and walk to Standard Press Steel and work. So I was really busy. You know, I was pursuing something, and you know, I managed not to drink or do drugs, you know. Somewhere along in those 6 years, towards the end of it, I got enrolled. You know, I was in nursing school. I met a woman. Things are going well. I'm doing good in school. A couple of the other women that lived, this was the highlight of my life. You know, I'm living in a dorm at nursing, Abington Hospital School of Nursing. I'm one of three men living in a dorm with 46 women. It was fabulous, you know. And it was, you know, there was no RAs or anybody supervising us. And my girlfriend, who lived down the hall, you know, it was just beautiful. But there was also some other people in my class that I could tell were like me, and they were smoking some pot. So I started doing that eventually. And you know, after I graduated nursing school in 1994, my then fiance or my girlfriend and I got engaged. And in 1995, we moved in together. In 1995, we went down to Aruba on a vacation. And here I am, 6 years since my last drink. I went to a casino, and, you know, in the big book, it talks about suddenly. You know, and this is my experience. You know, I'm sitting in a casino by myself because she didn't drink or she didn't gamble. And cocktail waitress came up and, you know, the free drinks. She said, "Can I get you something?" And without a thought, 7 and 7 sounds good. And I drank maybe 2 or 3 drinks that night. I didn't get drunk on that vacation. But it started, you know, it triggered the allergy. You know, when I got home from that vacation, now I had already been hiding the fact that I had started smoking pot again from my fiance. So I'm already living that double life. Now I'm drinking. And every night when she would go to work, I would run out to the steak and hoagie factory down there on Street Road or 611, and I would buy a couple 40s, quarts, whatever they were at that time, and drink those, go back out, get a couple more, and it was just, you know, I wouldn't go out and buy a case because I really didn't have anywhere to keep it. You know, if I didn't finish it, I couldn't, you know. But I would just keep going out and buying them. And this went on for, see, that vacation was in August of 95. My last drink was in April 12th of 1996. On April 12th, 1996, I had graduated nursing school. I was working on an oncology unit, and I was taking care of a man who we knew was going to die that night. I was surrounded by his family members. And he was in a lot of pain. He was on a continuous infusion of morphine. And at one point, his one son came out and said, "Isn't there something we can do to just ease his suffering?" He's just moaning out, it's awful for my siblings. My mom's can't take it anymore. Isn't there something we can do?" I called the physician who was on call that night, and I got an order to administer a dose of IV Valium. And I administered the dose of Valium, and within, I would say, no more than 2 minutes, the man died. You know, I can stand here today and absolutely tell you with clear understanding that ethically, legally, I didn't do anything wrong. I was following the physician's orders. And I don't believe I did anything wrong. He was going to die anyway. But I can also tell you that the way I felt inside that night, I could not wait until the end of the shift. I just needed to get out of there and blot that consciousness. You know, I just couldn't feel what I was feeling. I couldn't explain what I was feeling. I just knew I had to get rid of it. And the only thing I knew to get rid of uncomfortable feelings was either drugs or alcohol. You know, and I set out to try to find some weed because that, truthfully, was the one that I used all the time. You know, I absolutely know that I'm alcoholic. And when I look back over the years of my drug use, I see that, you know, the way I smoked pot, the way I used any other drugs was always I used them alcoholically. I don't consider myself a drug addict. You know, I was able to put those things down. You know, the one thing that I could not stop once I started was drinking. I left work that night, and I knew I needed to get loaded. Didn't take time to go home and change. I just proceeded to start driving, trying to find somebody that had some weed. And stopping at bars, every bar along the way, to get a couple more quarts. I don't know how much I drank. The last clear memory I have is around 2 o'clock at the General Davis Inn on Street Road in Warminster. I remember pulling into the parking lot. Vaguely remember getting out of my car. I remember standing inside the bar, begging the bartender to sell me just these 2 more quarts. With tears streaming down my face. I said, "You don't understand. I need this." He's like, "I'm sorry. It's after 2. I can't sell it to you." I somehow think I convinced him. I'm not sure if I did or not. I honestly don't know. The next thing I remember is pulling into the parking lot where I shared this apartment with my fiance. And her car was in the parking lot. And I was like, "Oh, crap." You know, she was supposed to have been out dancing with a girlfriend or something that night. I was not expecting her to be home. And as soon as I saw her car in the parking lot, I knew it was done. You know, I couldn't make it inside to the bathroom. I ended up wetting myself in the parking lot, trying to drag myself up the steps. And, you know, I'm halfway up the steps. I think I had fallen twice. And she turned on the light and said, "What is wrong with you?" You know, to this point, I think she maybe knew that I drank a few times, but just didn't realize because I kept it pretty well hidden. You know, at this point, we were only like 4 or 5 months away from the wedding we were planning. I woke up the next morning, came to whatever it was on the sofa, And having had some exposure to AA before, I knew that there was help available. And I asked her for the phone book. And I looked up in the white pages, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called the Glenside Clubhouse. And by the grace of God, there were two men sitting in that room that day, keeping the center open between meetings. And they encouraged me to, you know, take a shower, you know, try to sober up a little bit and come down to see them. And I'm not sure if I showered or not. I tend to think I probably didn't. I remember I was in sweats, and I'm sure I didn't smell good. But I went down to the clubhouse, and there was these two gentlemen there, and they were men who had come to AA looking for help and had heard a message of hope, and they had grasped on. And they later told me that they were terrified. They were both sitting there saying, God, I hope nobody calls. One of the guys had just under 30 days sober. The other guy had maybe 92 days sober. You know? So don't ever think if you're sitting out there and you're newly sober and you don't have a lot of experience that you can't help somebody, because you absolutely can. You know, I absolutely believe with all my heart that God does not call on the qualified, He calls on the willing. You know, if you're willing to serve and you make yourselves available and ask God to use you to help somebody else, He will do so. You don't have to know what you're doing. You just show up. And that has been my experience as well with sponsoring people, with trying to carry a message. You know, coming up here tonight, I had no idea what I was going to say. I didn't find out I was going to speak until 12 o'clock this afternoon, when the speaker who was scheduled from South Jersey called and said because of the 29 and a half inches of snow, she couldn't make it up here today. But I was told that, you know, when somebody asks you to do something, you don't say no unless you have a prior commitment. And I'm glad I'm here. So anyway, 1996, I had that last drink, and I went to AA, and I started to go to a lot of meetings, you know, and I stayed sober on half of the first step and a lot of fellowship for a lot of years. You know, it's not that I didn't try to do some of these steps. When I came in, I looked at them, and I said, yeah, I'm powerless. I need help. I don't know about that turning my will and my life over. I don't understand that, but I'll try to figure it out. And inventory, I don't know what it is, but I'll try. And, you know, and I'd gotten sponsors, and I'd asked for help. And, you know, I did do as thorough a fourth step as I could a couple times. You know, and I was able to make a couple amends, some crucial amends. But unfortunately, for whatever reason, the men that I had asked to sponsor me had not really gone through all the steps themselves either. You know, I don't know why that is today, and it doesn't really matter. You know, I got what I got, and I managed to stay sober. And it was a far cry better than drinking and the misery of drinking. You know, I look back now, and I think, you know, the fellowship kept me sober for a long time. And sober was pretty good compared to drunk and miserable. But the program, which I discovered a little over 2 years ago, has helped me to recover from this disease and given me a life worth living today. A life where I feel useful, contented, and whole. You know, in the foreword to the 12 and 12, there's this second paragraph. It says something about the 12 steps, when practiced as a way of life, can enable the sufferer to discover a useful and whole, purposeful life. And that has been my experience. You know, a little over two years ago, kind of fast forward, I'm not going to go through everything that happened in those years that I was sober. And let's see, 2001, I had been able to make amends with my father, thank God, because in 2001 he'd become pretty gravely ill. You know, my father's business he sold in 1999. His health started to decline at the age of like late 50s. He had his first stroke. He had ended up with kidney failure and was on dialysis, heart problems, had a defibrillator and all this stuff. And he wound up in the hospital in the spring of 2001 and didn't get out of the hospital until he died. He spent the last 3.5 months or so of his life in the hospital. And as a result of being sober and having made amends with my father, I was able to be present. And as a result of my training in nursing and years of experience dealing with death and dying, I knew what to do. And I was able to be there with him. And incredibly grateful for that opportunity. I would not trade those moments and, you know, those months for anything. And if you would look on the outside, you know, leading up to his death, I was doing all the right things. I was going to meetings. You know, I had a sponsor. It was really more in name only. I wasn't really being sponsored as I understand it today, but I did have a sponsor, and I talked to him occasionally. I didn't really talk to him about what was going on inside, but, you know, at least got some direction, you know, go to meetings, talk about it, and I did those things. And, you know, on July 12th of 2001, my father passed away, and I was sitting there holding his hand when he died. I was on the schedule to work that day, and I went into work. I tried to call my boss and said, you know, I had agreed to work because one of my coworkers had taken a day off or was on vacation or something. And I went in because I knew I needed to. But as soon as I got there, I asked, here's what happened. And I was up all night. Is there any way that you can get coverage and I can get out of here? And for whatever reason, they did not find coverage and they would not let me leave. Being alcoholic, that was a good cause for resentment. You know, I don't know about you guys, but justified resentments, justified or not, I can't afford them. You know, the literature is very clear. It's the number one killer. And it wasn't much longer after that I quit that job with nothing lined up. You know, I began working, doing some agency nursing, which was really good, pays a lot of money, not very stable, and not a lot of real direct supervision. People don't really get to know you, and some facilities don't secure all their narcotics. I was working on a contract assignment, and the facility I was working in did not lock up the sleeping pills and the Fiorinol, Fiorsets with codeine, and you know, all kinds of things that relieve pain in someone of my type. And I began to self-medicate without prescriptions. And at one point, in order negotiating another contract, I had to go for a pre-employment drug screen. And the drug screen came up hot. You know, here I am. In my mind, I'm thinking I'm like, six years sober, and now I have to go to the state's recovery program for nurses. You know, I couldn't be honest with myself. And even today, when people ask me what my sobriety date is, I don't know. You know, my sobriety date, the date of my last drink, you know, April 13th, 1996, was the first, you know, my first day sober, physically sober, separated from alcohol. The date of my last drug use was somewhere in April of 2001, you know, or I'm sorry, April of 2003. Been about 6 years. So I wind up on the state's program for nurses, and my ego, my pride really blocks me a lot, because now I have to go to meetings, and my ego is telling me, you know, I've got all this time sober, I'm chairing meetings, I started groups, and you know, and I have to get this paper signed. So I didn't like that very much, and to be honest, I probably owe the state's recovery program an amends for all the forged papers I turned in. I don't know. I hope they don't get a copy of the state, but I don't know. You know, it is what it is. In 2003 or so, I met a woman who fell in love with me. Why, I don't know. I didn't know who I was, to be honest, because I had not really gone through all the steps in this program, had not taken the time to really understand what made me tick. I didn't know who I was. I just knew I was empty, and I thought that maybe she would make me whole. I never really loved the woman. This is the saddest part in my story. You know, I married this woman who I never really loved. Fast forward a little bit. The fall of 2006, I'm dying on the inside. 2007. I'm literally, I get to a point where every day I wake up with this thought in my mind, and it's the only prayer that I had left towards the end was, please God, kill me. I hate my life. Please just kill me. I can't stand this another day. As I said, I got that I was powerless over alcohol. I didn't want to use drugs. I didn't want to blot anything out at this point. I knew that if I did that, it was just going to be a slow, painful misery. I just wanted to die. I didn't have the courage to kill myself. Actually, I didn't have the lack of courage to kill myself. I kept asking, I kept saying that prayer, and eventually I found a way. I had gotten in enough pain. Let me be honest here. I started looking outside of the marriage for something that's going to make me feel better. There was this married woman at work who at one point told me she was in love with me, and I started pursuing that, thinking that would make me feel better. New Year's Eve 2007 into, I'm sorry, I can't even get the dates right, 2007 into 2008, I told my wife that there was somebody else. She didn't take it very well. It was probably very selfish. It was really selfish. I remember sitting there with her literally having a breakdown and thinking I'm going to have to take her to the psych unit. And I acquiesced and said, "No, honey, I'm sorry. You know, we'll work it out." But my heart was not there. I could not follow through on that. I was making another empty promise. And I tried to stay there for another several months. Fast forward a little bit, June 15th, 2007. I woke up that morning, and I just knew that something was going to change this day. And I didn't know how it was going to happen or what was going to happen. A friend of mine from my old home group had run into an old sponsor of mine and had given him my number. I woke up that morning, and the wife and I had another argument. She had started taking my family's inventory, as she often did, and sharing their shortcomings with me, and you know, I naturally got defensive. So this old sponsor called me, and I said, "You know what, Mike? I'd love to talk, but I can't talk right now. I don't know what I'm doing, but I got to get out of here. I will call you later." And I left the house that morning, not knowing where I was going. By this point, I had really kind of stopped going to AA. I was showing up every 3 weeks, maybe every month. I would show up on my anniversary to get a coin and tell you how miserable I was. But I woke up that morning, when I left the house, I wound up in a 7-Eleven parking lot in Richland Town. And I called an old friend of mine. I talked for about 20 minutes. And he suggested I go to a meeting. And for some reason, I still had the Lehigh Valley directory in my car. And it was a Saturday. And it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I guess, when I was talking to him. And I looked, and there's this 5 o'clock Big Book meeting up in Bethlehem. And I went up there, and that was the first time I met Rhubarb, a couple other people that I've seen down here. And I walk in, and they're reading Working with Others. And just as we were reading that day, something clicked inside me. You know, I finally saw that the gift of sobriety that had been given to me so many years earlier was not for me. It was so that I could turn around and help somebody else. For some reason, I didn't get that. All those years, you know, I thought that I was struck sober so that I could go out and start accumulating material goods and, you know, make myself feel good and build up all this stuff on the outside. And here I am looking at the results of me running my life. You know, here I am, I'm in this marriage, I hate my wife, I bought a house I don't like, never liked, in the neighborhood I didn't want to live in. Have these two dogs that she got when I was on a business trip because she was insistent, and I finally caved and just said, whatever, as I gave her so many other things. And I just knew, you know, I needed to do something different. You know, and I decided that day that I needed to get out of the marriage. That was a really difficult decision. I mean, it wasn't a difficult decision. It was a difficult process. It was very easy. I couldn't stay. And, you know, it's one of the hardest things that I've gone through in the last 2 years is having to take an honest look at the amount of pain and suffering that I caused this woman who really didn't deserve that. You know, I know that she played a part and, you know, she goes to Al-Anon and she's learned how to take inventory and, you know, and I think she's on her own path. You know, and I hope that she's finding some peace. I'm not always so sure because there's still some struggles. You know, but the divorce papers were signed a couple months ago. The house was finally sold, and my desperation made me willing to take some actions I had not taken before that. I reached out my hand and I asked somebody for help. When I went to that first meeting, something clicked, and I just knew I needed to go to a lot of meetings. You know, I started going to meetings every day, and going to new meetings and reaching out my hand and getting honest and telling what was going on. And it took me about 4 or 5 weeks to finally ask this man to sponsor me. Somebody had suggested that I should come here to meet this guy. And I was resistant. I'm like, no, Monday night at 8 o'clock, I don't want to go to a meeting at 8 o'clock on a Monday night. I've got to go home and sleep or read or something, you know. And I actually met him up in Bethlehem at the Friday night Steel Hall meeting when this woman who had asked me to come here was speaking for her one-year anniversary, and she's no longer around. I have not seen her anyway. I pray that she's okay today, but at that meeting, she had her sponsor speak, and this man that had become my sponsor speak. And after that meeting, I went out for pizza with these guys, and I got to know the man who took me through the steps and saved my life. Sadly, you know, a year or so later, a little less than a year later, you know, this man who gave me everything fell asleep for a little while and decided that a drink looked good. By God's grace, he came back and he's, you know, just celebrated 6 months. You know, he didn't stay out very long, and I'm really grateful. I'm sorry he couldn't be here tonight. But the day he called me and told me that, you know, look for the speaker tonight. It was a Monday. He told me to come here and look for the speaker tonight because he wasn't going to be here. He was drinking. You know, I was struck suddenly, you know, right away. I knew. I don't know what to do with this. You know, here's this man who has given me so much, and he's drinking. What do I do? One thing he taught me, when I asked him to sponsor me, he said two things to me. He said I would be honored, and he said, please understand that my job is not to tell you how to run your life. It's to try to help you find a power by which you can solve your problem, and that's where you need to go when you're stuck. You know, he said, don't call me with your problems. Go to God and then call me. And, you know, so when I got that text message, I immediately went into the bathroom at work and I hit my knees and I said, God, I don't know what to do. And it became really clear to me. Go to the meeting and get another sponsor. Go to the meeting, make the coffee like you've always done, and get another sponsor before the night's out. And I did that. And, you know, it was 3 or 4 days later that another friend that I met in these rooms called me, and she was despondent and suicidal and wanting to drink. And it's kind of similar situation, but a completely different response. You know, my mind can't come up with this stuff, but God can. You know, because when she called, I didn't know what to do. And I got down and I asked, what do I do? I'm at work. It's a Friday afternoon. It's 1 o'clock. I've got this young girl who's saying she wants to kill herself. What do I do? You know, and I left work to try to go get her. Fortunately, someone else got to her first and got her into the hospital, and I kept up with her. And things looked good until a few weeks ago when, you know, on Halloween she drank again. And she's been struggling since, and I chatted with her earlier today, and she said, you know, it's so sad that so many people don't want to be around me right now because I'm drinking. This is a girl who's young. She's got her disease. You know, she's in college, and she's got this mind that's telling her she doesn't fit in because she's around all these college kids, and they're drinking and having fun, and she just wishes she could do that. And she says, you know, I'm coming home. I'm finishing up my finals today, and I'm coming home. She said, I'd love to see you, but if you don't want to be around me because I'm drinking, I understand. And I said, no, absolutely, you know, I don't care if you're drinking. You know, it has nothing to do with it. You know, sure, I would love to see her sober, but, you know, I've learned that what we do isn't so important as why we do it. My responsibility when I try to help somebody is not, or when I try to be helpful to somebody, is not to get them sober or to fix their problems. It's to help them find the powers within themselves to do so. You know, a little over 10 months ago, I was in a spot where I was really struggling, obsessing about another woman who was really not available. And yeah, go figure. I have this tendency to, I should say, I had this tendency to be attracted to women that weren't available, and to look outside for something to make me okay. And I asked God to help me, and within 2 days, I had 3 guys ask me to sponsor them. Would love to say they're all still here. You know, one guy's here now. One's coming home from Ohio in a couple days, and I hope to get together with him. The other one, I believe, is staying sober without AA. You know, I don't see him all that often because he's pretty isolated and doesn't return calls. But, you know, being praying and asking for help and having these three guys show up at that time saved me again. You know, because here I am, I'm obsessed and I'm about to go out of the doors again because I'm not getting my way. And, you know, I found that the best solution for me when I get stuck in my head is to reach out my hand to somebody else, you know, and offer to just listen, you know, just ask them, what can I do to help you? I don't always do it very well. You know, I have another guy that I've been working with who this weekend I was supposed to get together with, and it just didn't happen because of the weather and whatever reasons. And really, it was probably my own selfishness because I still have that tendency. You know, my default is to think of me. You know, I got up, I recently started seeing somebody, and that's going really well. And it's kind of frightening in and of itself. First time I ever started seeing somebody in the program who understands what I'm doing and is doing the same things herself. And it's awesome, but it's also a great responsibility. You know, and I've got this man that I was helping go through the steps, and I haven't seen him in a couple of weeks. And he reached out his hand to me the other day and wanted to get together, and I let him down. You know, and I had to deal with that last night when I did, you know, a little check at night. You know, and I had to look at that and say, you know what, I sent him a text and I haven't heard from him today. I need to follow up. You know, he works 3 to 11 shifts. I don't see him during the week. It's only during the weekends that we can even get together. And I have to follow up on that tonight. You know, I would love to say I do everything perfectly, and that would be an absolute lie. You know, the one thing that I do is I practice. It's every morning when I get up, I ask God to please get me out of the way. You know, show me what I can do to help somebody else. Remind me throughout the course of the day, you know, that it's not my job to fix my life. You know, my job is to try to help somebody else and to trust God, whatever that is, you know, to take care of me. And when I come from that place, from a place of service, you know, and just trying to serve somebody else, you know, my life takes care of itself, and it does so in a way that I could never have imagined. You know, and I talk about this relationship that I'm in now, and truthfully, I've grown more in the last couple months. You know, it just sometimes amazes me, you know, the capacity to be honest and to share, and you know, to just admit that I'm afraid. You know, to just admit to her, you know. And I had to make amends to her last Sunday night because I'm still, by default, selfish. You know, she had reached out to me one day when she was upset and I didn't respond the way that a person who was loving would respond. I just kind of texted her instead of calling. Simple little thing, but, you know, the ability, you know, sitting across from my sponsor last Sunday and doing another fifth step, you know, he was able to point out some things to me. You know, I went over a list of how I've treated people in relationships, and he was able to point out all these defects that I have. You know, selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, arousing jealousy, bitterness, suspicion, all those things on that sexual inventory. And he went down this list of like a dozen women that I had relationships with, and every single one of them had checks in all the columns until I got down to this present relationship. They had checks in all the columns except for dishonesty. And he's like, so you're making progress. And I was like, okay. You know, so what do I do? I, you know, he says, you have an opportunity here. You know, he says, clean it up now before it gets, you know, disgusting. He said, you know, you just go and tell her the truth. Tell her, you know, you're afraid and you don't know how to do this. And she understands that, and that's an amazing thing, you know. And that night after I made that amends to her, she's like, you know, I'm not sure I really want to do this. And a couple months ago, my life was really good. I was happy. She says, this whole relationship thing is very challenging. But we're doing it anyway. You know, we made a commitment. And who knows where it's going to go. I know one thing, we're both growing, you know. And that's what I believe it's about. Learning how to grow, to be responsible, to be present. You know, my greatest enemy is right inside, between my ears. You know, when I get stuck in my thoughts, I'm in trouble. You know, and the one thing, you know, even today, thinking about coming here, my stomach was upset all day. I wasn't thinking about what I was going to say. It was just the idea of having to stand up in front of a room full of people who, you know, it may not all be people that I've gotten to know. There's certainly some unfamiliar faces, but there's an awful lot of people here who have touched my life in a tremendous way over the last year and a half. And the gratitude that I feel in my heart, I probably can't express in words. You know, I hope that my actions demonstrate that. All my life I tried to tell you how I felt. Today I just try to show you, you know. I don't know, I think that's it.